From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Democratic Party has been at serious odds with President Donald Trump, except when it comes to military spending. Earlier this month, a majority of Democrats in the House and the Senate joined their Republican colleagues in voting for a massive $716 billion military spending bill. The vote was rushed through and handed Trump a major victory. Trump had asked for an increase to the already bloated military budget in January. He faced almost no opposition in Congress. Despite the fact that U.S. wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and elsewhere have caused untold death, destruction, and an unprecedented refugee crisis, the U.S. military continues to expand, even as other social programs are chronically underfunded. My guest is Corey Peterson-Smith, Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Corey.
Thank you, Sonali.
Why do you think the president faced almost no opposition on this? I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that Democrats joined Republicans, that they essentially handed Trump a victory, because in general, militarism has been a bipartisan affair, right?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. It really points to a serious problem that we have in the United States that, I would argue that in general, I don't see nearly enough difference between the Republicans or Democrats. But particularly when it comes to questions of militarism and U.S. empire, they are absolutely united. And if I could add to what you said, I agree completely that they gave it's not just that they didn't oppose Trump and that they gave him what he wanted, but they actually gave him even more than what they wanted. That is, you see, in this budget, the Congress actually giving money for three more ships than the Navy asked for. The budget funds the construction of 13 new ships, and that's three beyond what the Pentagon actually asked for. That is what the Trump administration asked for. And so, so the Congress, when it comes to questions of militarism, Congress is actually working to outdo the Trump administration.
It's quite incredible, and I suppose this is a sort of culture in Washington that one has to prove one's allegiance to the military to be considered, you know, a patriotic member of Congress or something like that. But we don't hear, but there was a time when, for example, the U.S. war in Iraq generated enough outrage in the public that members of Congress worried about seeming too hawkish. It's not as though our wars have all wrapped up, especially in the Middle East, right? Why is it that the destruction and death that the U.S. foments in the Middle East through our militarism isn't making it into the national dialogue, isn't impacting decision-making on military funding?
That's a great question. And I think that you're absolutely right to point to, in the lead up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq, it was a massive outpouring of opposition, of popular opposition, by ordinary people protesting. That's where the opposition to the war started. And it found some reflection in Congress. And as you said, even for those people in Congress who voted for the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we knew who they were. I mean, in the 2004 election, and then again in 2008 in particular, when it was on the Democratic side, when Obama was running against Hillary Clinton, one of the things that everybody knew is that Hillary Clinton voted to support the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And there was a certain accountability there that one had. I don't think that people who voted for the invasion were held nearly accountable enough. But there was an understanding that many people in this country opposed the invasion. And if you, as a congressperson, voted for it, then you have to answer for that. And it's been, I think, unfortunately, the receding of that tide of resistance and the demobilization of the anti-war movement in particular that has allowed now there's no opposition. Certainly, that there is no reflection of the kind of anti-war sentiment. We don't see that reflected in Congress at all. And there's basically been a consensus that actually we need to beef up the military. That is what the Congress has said by passing this budget.
Let's talk about the war in Yemen. This is a war that has been going on for several years now, hasn't gotten much attention in the US, although the US doesn't necessarily have frontline troops doing the shooting and the bombing. It is present in Yemen in a very big way, right? It's supporting the Saudi war against Yemen. What did the defense spending bill, which is just basically, a military spending bill,
Right.
include in its fine print about the Yemen war.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I want to answer, but first I want to provide just a little bit of background and context because at the moment, well, truthfully, at the moment, we're not exactly sure what the US personnel themselves are doing in Yemen. And it's really one of the consequences of what we were just talking about. The demobilization of an anti-war movement means that without any kind of force holding the US accountable, we don't even know where all there are military operations taking place in the world. So we know that there are all kinds of special operations happening in lots of places. We're not exactly sure what's happening in Yemen, but at the moment, the primary bombardment of Yemen, and it's really been, Yemen is a besieged country, and it's a total nightmare. And the primary combatants causing the destruction are Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and then their allies that are part of what they call a coalition. Now, in the U.S. is deeply implicated in that. Now, it is the case that not too long ago, the United States itself was more or less openly carrying out operations in Yemen too. It should be said that under Obama, actually, there were cruise missile strikes in Yemen by the United States. There were drone strikes in Yemen by the United States. And so, not too long ago, the US was very directly carrying out attacks in
But
Yemen.
its target in Yemen was quite different, right?
Right. So, the claim was that the target was fighting Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. In reality, as in general with the so-called war on terror, there are many civilians and non-combatants who were injured and killed in those campaigns. And similarly, today, as Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they frame their operations as intervening in a civil war in Yemen. And they, again, claim to be targeting this group of rebels, the Houthis. And in reality, there's all kinds of destruction affecting civilians and non-combatants. Now, to get to your question about what this latest bill supports in Yemen. One of the things that it actually calls attention to is the fact that the United States has been involved in refueling, mid-air refueling of Saudi and UAE aircraft. And so it's Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates who are dropping the bombs, and the United States is doing mid-air refueling. It's actually also supporting intelligence for the dropping of the bombs. And by the way, the bombs, of course, the United States has sold billions of dollars in weapons to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, as well as aircraft. So it's true that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are carrying out incredible destruction in Yemen, and they should absolutely be held accountable. But they're doing this destruction with planes made in the United States, with the bombs they're dropping are from the United States. The United States is fueling their aircraft. The United States is supplying the intelligence for their missions. So the US is essentially doing everything but actually dropping the bombs.
Wow. Now, the Al-Qaeda connection is really critical here because it's there's news just now that Saudi Arabia has essentially done a deal with Al-Qaeda, is essentially now on the same side as Al-Qaeda in Yemen. And if the US is supporting, backing, essentially, proxy fighting that war, if Saudi is proxy fighting a US war, the US has gone from fighting Al Qaeda in Yemen to being on the same side as Al Qaeda in Yemen. I mean, just thinking about this in the framework of the September 11th attacks, where Al Qaeda was held responsible for the worst terrorist attack in US history, we now have the US fighting alongside the people, the group, the same group in Yemen.
Right. It's interesting because one of the provisions of this latest bill passed by Congress, this so-called defense spending bill, is that the United States is not allowed to sell weapons to Al-Qaeda, among other organizations, ISIS as well. And so, as you say, this latest news, it's really interesting. And I will see how the U.S. government squares the fact that Congress is prohibiting the sale of weapons and kind of aiding of organizations like Al-Qaeda, when in fact the U.S., by virtue of its alliances, is in practice doing that thing. Now, it's really ironic, I'm sure, for your viewers and listeners to hear that the United States is essentially, by virtue of its alliance with Saudi Arabia, has been working with or supporting Al-Qaeda. But it's also the case that this has a history, too. I mean, Al-Qaeda itself emerged from the conflict in Afghanistan in the 1980s, in which Osama bin Laden, amongst other Islamic fundamentalist fighters, were fighting the Soviet Union. And those forces fighting the Soviet Union were actually funded by the United States via Pakistan. And so that actually was, the United States not only funded those forces, but President Reagan invited Mujahideen fighters to the White House and called them freedom fighters and so on. And from that very kind of context emerged Al-Qaeda. And so there's actually a history of the United States funding forces on one hand that then it declares are the world's greatest enemies, only to apparently fund them again in the future.
So in the brutal war, Saudi war on Yemen, the latest has been that Saudi Arabia has bombed the port city of Hodeidah. This is where medical supplies are coming in for the nation, which is the most impoverished nation in the Gulf, right? This is essentially the poorest nation in the Gulf, right up against the richest nation in the Gulf, which is Saudi Arabia, and now the richest and perhaps, we can say with the exception of Israel, the most well-armed nation in the Middle East. So we have this ongoing war in Yemen. What do you make of the fact that there hasn't been very much media coverage at all? There was one media watchdog group that found that MSNBC hadn't mentioned the war in Yemen for a year. I mean, that feeds into letting this sort of bloated military budget and the support for this war to continue unopposed.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and it's one reason why I'm so grateful that you're talking about it on your program, because it's really quite criminal, not only what the U.S. is doing and supporting in Yemen, but the fact that the U.S. corporate media say virtually nothing about it. And it really, it's an absolute catastrophe what's happening. At the moment, I mean, not only have tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed since what's really been a scorched earth war led by Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. It's a war in which they're very obviously targeting civilian infrastructure. They target not only bridges and mosques, but actually medical facilities. Medical facilities operated by Doctors Without Borders have been bombed by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And as you said, they've also attacked ports and other nodes of infrastructure such that there's tremendous vulnerability of Yemenis. And there's such a level, the economy was already a nightmare before this war. As you said, Yemen is the poorest country in the Middle East. And so obviously the war itself has been a shock to the economy. And so many Yemenis are dependent on aid coming in from outside the country. Well, when Saudi Arabia and the UAE target ports and target roads and bridges and other infrastructure, you're really causing humanitarian catastrophe. And so according to the United Nations, every child in Yemen, virtually every child in Yemen, is at risk for disease and for starvation. That's really the level of humanitarian devastation that exists in Yemen at the moment.
Let's talk about some other aspects of this bill. What does it say, for example, on nuclear weapons spending? I mean, this is so sad that in 2018, we're still talking about the U.S. military and nuclear defense spending. Trump has made a huge deal during his campaign about nuclear weapons. He unsurprisingly likes the idea of nuclear weapons. Most bullies do, and has vowed to increase the government's the U.S.'s nuclear weapons arsenal. And did Congress hand him, did Congress essentially with their vote agree with him on that?
Well, you're right. And, it's always important to talk about nuclear weapons and the threat that they continue to pose to humanity and the planet. But it's particularly relevant this week because a couple of days ago, August 6th, is the anniversary, the 73rd anniversary of the US bombing of Hiroshima with the atomic bomb at the end of World War II. And tomorrow is the 73rd anniversary of the US bombing of Nagasaki. The United States remains the only country to use atomic bombs in combat, and they did so to target civilian populations, of course. And in addition to using nuclear weapons in combat, the United States has also, through nuclear testing, poisoned generations of people in the Pacific, in the southwestern United States, in particular, in communities with high concentrations of indigenous folks. So there's a whole lot to talk about when we talk about the US's nuclear infrastructure and why it really needs to be dismantled. Unfortunately, as you said, this bill does the very opposite. It actually appropriates $65 million for new research and development in so-called low-yield nuclear weapons or so-called tactical nuclear weapons. And the idea behind weapons like these is that they aren't quite as destructive as the bombs that were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Military planners and strategists imagine using them in combat situations in the context of a military conflict, that is, between combatants. Now, because they're not so powerful as to obliterate whole cities, but they're nuclear weapons nonetheless, there are those who believe that there's actually a higher likelihood of the use of these so-called low-yield nuclear weapons, because the idea is, well, we're not going to destroy a whole city, we can just use these for tactical purposes. And so these weapons are actually, they unfortunately make the use of nuclear weapons more realistic. And I'll add that, as with so many things, this particular earmark in the budget, it's criminal, but it didn't start now under the Trump administration. Actually, under the Obama administration, there was research and development put into these so-called low-yield weapons as well. So it's really a continuation of a new generation of nuclear warfare, which is terrifying.
I just wanted another side on the issue of the weapons purchases in this bill. The Trump administration has put its faith in F-35 stealth bombers, but in recent days, reporters and members of the media and commentators, people on social media, have pointed out that Trump doesn't even quite understand how F-35s work. He literally thinks these stealth bombers are invisible or can be invisible in the sky. And I just wish I was joking when I was saying this. I wish we were talking about satire, but I don't know if you've heard this. So many statements that he's made suggest he really believes the F-35 is an invisible flying machine.
I mean, it's pretty incredible. I mean, and the truth is, like, he clearly doesn't understand how these weapons work. He doesn't understand how a lot of things work, and yet they're devastating nonetheless. I mean, unfortunately, the F-35 is highly visible and highly destructive, not only as a weapon in combat, but in places like Vermont, where the F-35 has actually been tested, where there's been quite an impressive resistance to the testing of the F-35 by activists, because A, Vermonters don't want to be implicated in the destruction that this war machine commits abroad, but B, because this so-called invisible weapon actually it produces tremendous noise pollution in Vermont communities, and it really if you've heard a warplane fly, if you've heard jets fly and conduct exercises, I mean, before they even drop a bomb, the flight of jet aircraft itself is terrifying. And that's what the people who live in the places where they actually test and develop these weapons have had to deal with. And so there's been an incredible resistance. Whether the Trump, President Trump, knows that these planes are visible, there are people who understand that they are visible and are resisting them.
What about Guantanamo? Funding for Guantanamo, this Gulag, as many have referred to it since September 11th, going back to our conversation around Al-Qaeda, which is, the battle against Al-Qaeda was what first started the populating of this prison with prisoners who have been denied their due process rights, who have been essentially imprisoned indefinitely. Now the U.S. is essentially on the same side as Al-Qaeda in Yemen, but does it continue to fund a Guantanamo?
Yes, I'm really glad you brought that up. Not only does it continue to fund Guantanamo, but it really takes measures to prohibit the closing of Guantanamo. One thing that it prohibits is the transfer of people who are being held in Guantanamo to the continental United States. Just to be clear, I'm for the closure of this prison and this base that the prison is part of, and the release of people who've been held for years without any charge. Which is really quite incredible. There are people being held in Guantanamo for whom there's no evidence that they've done anything wrong, and yet, shrouded in secrecy, they're being held in this Byzantine legal system. I think they should be released altogether. There has been a conversation in Congress that says, well, what if we start by bringing people to the continental United States as a first step to closing the prison? Even that is prohibited in this latest budget. The other thing is that it actually singles out people who are being held in Guantanamo Bay from particular countries, such as Somalia and Yemen, I believe. From being released, not only can they not be released in the United States or to their country of origin, but they also can't be released to any third country either. There have been some countries that have stepped forward and said, we will take on people who are from Guantanamo Bay. If they can't be, if the United States won't take them and the United States won't allow them to be repatriated to their countries of origin, we'll take them. I know Uruguay did this, for example, and this latest budget actually prohibits that kind of thing for people from a particular country. So it really continues what is an ongoing crime being committed by the United States at Guantanamo.
And of course, the huge irony here also is that the refugee crisis that Europe faces, an unprecedented historic refugee crisis over the past several years, is deeply linked to all of the militarism that the U.S. has engaged in alongside its European allies in these countries that are continuing to be subjected to U.S. militarism, all of which is funded in bill after bill every year. The issue of refugees just doesn't come up, right?
You're absolutely right. And, I think it's so important what you're doing, which is making the link between the kind of crises that we've seen at borders, where at the borders of Fortress Europe, or at the southern border of the United States, tens of thousands of people, in some cases hundreds of thousands of people, arrive wanting refuge. And we've seen people drowning in the Mediterranean and so on. And while there has been a very important conversation about these refugees and about what to do with them, and there are people like me who are saying that, of course, Europe and the United States and every country has the responsibility to let refugees in, there has been too little conversation about what situations are so nightmarish that they would lead so many people to flee their homes to begin with. And to get at that, we have to get at what the United States is doing, what the United States has done and continues to do in Central America that produces refugee flows of refugees from Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because whenever we talk about the refugee crisis in Europe, we also need to remind ourselves there is a refugee crisis on our own doorstep of our creation in part. Yeah.
Absolutely, 100%, and then it's also the case that this the people who are struggling to get into Europe, to the people who are detained at their borders, so many of them are pushed out by things the United States does. This, just to circle back to Yemen, by essentially continuing to fund what Saudi Arabia and the UAE are doing, it will continue to cause this destruction that produces refugees to begin with. It's also worth saying that one of the things that this bill does is gives funding to Oman, which is another neighboring country, another country that neighbors Yemen in addition to Saudi Arabia. It gives funding to Oman for border security. And it happens to be the case that Oman is building a wall on its border with Yemen. And so the United States is funding that. And therefore, not only is it the case that the United States is aiding in every way, really, except for dropping the bombs itself, Saudi Arabia and the UAE in bombing Yemen. And by the way, the budget says that the Secretary of State needs to certify that Saudi Arabia and the UAE aren't targeting civilians in order to continue the U.S. aid flowing. But there are exceptions. For example, if the coalition is fighting al-Qaeda, you know, fighting terrorism, and if it is deemed that there's a threat to national security, then of course it's okay for the U.S. to go ahead and do this. So you know, that will continue the destruction in Yemen, but it's also the case that Yemenis continue to be hemmed in to Yemen by the U.S. funding so-called border security by Oman.
Wow. Corey, let's put all of this money into context. Rolling Stone had an interesting piece asking, what could we do with $716 billion? And that's an important question to ask. While, of course, the $716 billion does include, you know, funding for military personnel, such as members of the armed forces, a lot of it is just, you know, extra money that the military didn't even ask for. And there's just never enough money for healthcare, never enough money for other critical social programs that are deemed welfare or entitlement programs. We should remind ourselves, shouldn't we, that this money is our taxpayers' money. And it could go towards things that actually benefit us, you know, here in the United States, with so many Americans continuing to struggle.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, there has been a live debate. There continues to be a live debate about, for example, the demand of Medicare for all, right? That the United States could finally join really every comparable country. Whether we're talking about Canada, the countries of Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, they all have some form of universal health care, you know. And there is this question of whether the United States can finally have such a thing. We know that there's an enormous health care crisis in this country. And not only is the conservative response that, well, actually the free market is the best way to do healthcare, which we just know is absolutely false. It's less efficient than the systems in other countries. But it's also the case that they say, well, there's just not enough money. Where are we going to pay for that? How are we going to pay for that? And the truth is, the $717 billion that Congress has just given the Pentagon to fund the destruction of people could absolutely be redirected toward healthcare. It's also the case that there's been a conversation recently by virtue of teachers waging really, I think, heroic fights in states like West Virginia and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Carolina and Kentucky. Teachers are demanding funding for their own wages and benefits, which are really criminally low, but also funding for schools, because the kind of budgets that fund schools are so low. And we've seen video and images and heard students and teachers talk about these decades-old textbooks, et cetera, crumbling schools. Well, this problem could be solved overnight if the money that that Congress has just given to fund weaponry could be redirected toward education.
Right.
If I could say just one more thing about the question of military personnel, because that is part of there's this kind of notion that the United States supports its troops, and that's where this money is going to. And in fact, there is a raise that goes to military personnel that's funded in this budget. It's quite a paltry raise, first of all, but we also see at the same time as they're passing this budget, we see scandal after scandal in the Veterans Administration healthcare system, where in fact the soldiers who are sent abroad to participate in U.S. violence come back and are mistreated by the VA here. And so the fact is, the majority of the money that's being that's part of this budget doesn't go to military personnel. It actually goes to weapons like the F-35, like the 13 new warships that are approved to be built.
So much for support the troops. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Corey. Where's a good place for people to read your writings and follow your work?
Oh, well, thank you. If you go to In These Times, I've written a piece recently, actually, about the crisis in Yemen, and which is again not only a crisis of the United States funding destruction in Yemen, but also the fact that the U.S. has that Trump, as part of his travel ban, refuses to let Yemenis into the country, and so many people in this country were moved by the real nightmare that the U.S. committed at the southern border, detaining children and separating them from their families and so on. And we absolutely need to demand justice for people from Central America to come into this country. It's also the case that even though we may not hear the cries of Yemeni children, they too are separated by the travel ban. So you can go to In These Times and read that. I'll also just plug a recent piece by Lindsay Kashgarian, who also works here at the Institute for Policy Studies, who wrote a piece that gets at precisely what $717 billion could fund other than war.
We'll link to both of those from our website. Thank you so much, Corey, for joining us.
Thank you.
Corey Peterson-Smith is the Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been discussing the bipartisan $716 billion military budget bill that Congress passed. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RU with Sonali.